Who are you?
Tim Callender.
Summer Brooks.
Brett Filipek.
We host the Babylon podcast.
What do you want?
To study and discuss the Babylon 5 universe.
Where are you going?
To discover every scrap of B5 memorabilia.
Who do you serve, and who do you trust?
And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And today is the day where we listen to you. We listen to your opinions. We answer your questions and tell you that sometimes your opinions are just wrong because we say so. Only sometimes.
And speaking of opinions, uh-oh. I have something here. Yes, are you ready for this? Following the rabbit hole down that is the interwebs.
Uh-oh.
I came across a site called iFanboy. Lowercase I, uppercase fanboy, and it's looking through it, there's a podcast which I haven't checked into. It's primarily a comics website. And one of the things I stumbled across, and it's a little dated, but I thought I'd share this here because people listening to the podcast have an interest. This is written by a contributor named Ron Richards. I know nothing about Ron Richards, so take everything I'm about to say here. You know, just I've stumbled across this one article. Ron writes his list of the worst thing in comics in 2010. Okay,
wow.
And it goes from 10 to 1. And number 10 on the list is J. Michael Straczynski.
Wow, really?
And he writes, "What's this you say? How can the author of one of the most successful graphic novels of 2010, Superman Earth 1, be at the top of my worst of 2010 list?" He says, "Regular readers of iFanboy should already know the answer to this, but for those of us not in the know, while the sales of Superman Earth 1 were indeed great, the book itself is so-so in my opinion. In addition to that, the amount of pain and frustration JMS caused this year was nearly unheard of. 2010 started off innocently enough, with him starting at DC Comics by doing one-shots on The Brave and the Bold, and they were quite good. It seemed as if he was getting the Claremont-esque treatment of being given an island to go play on. But then they announced the Superman Earth 1 graphic novel, and on top of that, they announced that he'd be writing both Superman and Wonder Woman's ongoing series. On top of that, he'd be writing the controversial new Wonder Woman in the newly designed Jim Lee costume, which featured Wonder Woman blinking out of existence within the normal DC universe. And on top of that, his Superman run would feature Superman walking the roads of America to get back in touch with the people. Now, I'm not going to judge too harshly. I heard some people enjoyed Wonder Woman, but some of those Superman stories sounded like the oddest opposite of Superman stories I'd ever expect. But the stories weren't the cause of JMS to be one of the worst things about comics. No, it was the fact that, once again, JMS was unable to finish what he started. Superman and Wonder Woman felt a chronic lateness, which eventually led to JMS being replaced by Chris Roberson, and Phil Hester, respectively, on the top titles at DC Comics. He was handed the keys to the kingdom, and like before with Rising Stars and the 12, JMS let a lot of people down. Shame, JMS, shame.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
I must have missed something. What did he drop the ball on Rising Stars too?
I don't know.
I thought that was sort of completed.
I thought so too.
I don't know, because I found this huge graphic novel compendium of all, I mean, literally, this book is a first strike weapon. It's the biggest graphic novel I've ever seen. It's about the size of one of Stephen Erickson's Malazan Book of the Fallen volumes. It's a huge book. It's glossy paper, which makes it heavier.
Yeah, right.
So it weighs twice as much as a regular novel its size. It's a trade paperback, you know, the big oversized, well, not oversized trade, but it's graphic novel sized, about, feels like 600 pages. It's a huge freaking book. It's heavy. You drop it on your foot, something's going to break. So if you're telling me that's incomplete, OMG.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to any of that, and not being as big a comics fan as I know some of our listeners are, you know, I just have to take, and again, this is just one man's opinion, you know, because I, you know, this isn't to excuse JMS. If he's bitten off more than he can chew, then there's only one person responsible for that. But, you know, he's also writing a half dozen screenplays. Sounds like he's been working on either new show concepts or discussing becoming showrunner. And the fact that I don't think I'm ever going to get my Lensman movie, the rest of you can suck it.
Alrighty then. Well, you know, at least Ron is very detailed in his reasoning, and I can appreciate that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He made his argument. He supported his argument with data points, and yep. You know, I'm like, hey, okay, no problem. Yep. Do you by any chance have any emails there about new books from favorite people of ours?
I do. I was just going to say. Friend of the show, Neil, sent along this little bit. Pat Tallman makes this announcement about her book on the Facebook page, her Facebook page, by the way. And she writes, Pat does, my new book, Pleasure Thresholds, Patricia Tallman's Babylon 5 scrapbook, will be premiering at San Diego Comic-Con. It's my personal pictures and stories from behind the scenes while we meet Babylon 5. The preview is a limited release. I'll have 50 copies for sale at $40 each and include a special Comic-Con signature page. Come see me Friday at 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Oh, that's, I guess, Friday AA 10 or Saturday AA 1, 3 p.m. to 1 p.m. or 4 p.m. I'm going to guess that. AA1 and the AA10 have a room or something.
Yeah, those are probably different rooms at the convention center.
And she says, please send me a message on the Facebook page so I can hold a book for you. And Neil sends a link and we'll get that posted up on the website. So, yes, hopefully preview means there's going to be a general wider release.
Yes, that was my understanding. There's going to be a general release for us mere mortals to get to, but the folks who go to San Diego Comic-Con will get special pre-release editions, limited, signed, all that good stuff.
Signed, sealed, delivered.
Yes.
Yeah. And you'll probably get to say hello to the lovely Pat Tallman, which is worth the price of admission right there, in my humble opinion. Mm-hmm. So there you go. All right. That's all I've got for the open today. I thought everybody would be interested in those two little tidbits.
No, I saw an email about a book that Harlan's coming
out with. Oh, yeah. And you know what? I'll dig that up and we'll share that at the close because I don't have that.
All right. In that case, we will take a really quick break and get on to your voicemail messages.
Listen, I know how you feel. I've been there. You feel like you had a dream to write once. There were stories in your head that were unparalleled and so much better than the stuff you bought in bookstores. You would be an author. You would show them all. But maybe along the way, you got discouraged. Maybe you bowed to the demands of life, family, career. Maybe you just thought you wouldn't be good enough, or that it was too late. But I'm here to tell you, you should be writing. At 5 years old, I Should Be Writing is one of the first writing podcasts. Author Mer Lafferty speaks to wannabe writers on the issues of keeping going from the beginning early stages of writing to keeping professional in the later stages of building a career. I speak weekly to professional authors about their work, their process, and advice that they have for you. There really is nothing stopping you. No, not that. Not that either. Nope. Whatever you're thinking of, it can't stop you. Trust me. Listen to I Should Be Writing at ishouldbewriting.com and learn more. Twice weekly and free. ishouldbewriting.com, because you should be writing.
But I should be writing. I should be working on my craft.
Feedback, feedback, listener feedback.
You want it? We got it.
Yeah.
I mean, still got it.
It literally is. Nice. It literally is the validation that we crave for doing this. Knowing that you're still listening, you still have questions about what we're talking about, that makes this all worthwhile.
Yeah, because we have such delicate egos otherwise.
Well, no, I mean, it's great to have an argument, even if that argument is in a closed circle of friends.
Yeah,
if you're arguing and no one's listening to you, that's just really sad.
Yes, but arguing isn't just the automatic gainsaying of what the other person says.
The argument is more fun when a third person butts in and goes, but wait a minute.
Yeah, you're both idiots. All right, Mike, play the first idiot.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie. I listen to Show 238 in the discussion of what if Babylon 5 had been made later. And I am in total agreement with Tim. I don't think that we'd have a better show going darker or having more latitude in what was being shown there, really, because the only thing that I could see might be better if they had a new stab at it would be, smoothing out some of the rough edges, doing the season 4, season 5 storylines a bit more spread out, but that's only if they knew that they had 5 seasons. And in this day and age, you don't know that, so the same problem might also take place. So I'm in agreement with him that what we got possibly might be the best Babylon 5 that we're going to get. A remake would not improve the story value. It would improve special effects there with the budget. But and then one other thing that Summer said about everything being rushed, part of the Babylon 5 paradigm from JMS was that things weren't rushed. He had the script. The scripts were well in advance, so they had a reasonable shooting schedule there. And they were getting things done in advance. Some of the special, they had lead time for special effects to get them done. Some of them were coming in at the last minute, but they did have everything all well planned out. That's all.
You know, I'll also offer another observation. I think that the space-based science fiction show, or even movies for that matter, are really in a they're at an ebb right now. Superheroes are big. If it's science fiction, it still tends to be with a terrestrial bent. Witness Eureka or Warehouse 13. You know, even the reimagined Battlestar Galactica, even though that was on a spaceship, the fact is that other than the exterior scenes, given the costuming and the overall feel of it, it could have been very contemporary. You know, the fighter jocks weren't wearing anything that current fighter jocks are wearing. You know, all the civilians were wearing neckties. So I think a Babylon 5 today, new or reimagined, would have a difficult time of it because I don't think the general audience is there for that kind of thing.
I don't know. I guess I think people are taking my saying that the story could have been a little darker, a little farther than I intended them to, and that's probably a little.
Yeah. Well, you could put on HBO and you get 40% more boob on it.
More boobs does not necessarily make a story darker, okay? Jeez, really?
Well,
I don't know. I guess if the series were to be remade, yes, we'd like to see more budget for special effects. And there were some story points where we could have dug deeper into various characters' dark sides just to find out a little bit more of what made them tick in that particular instance. And I don't know if that, you know, necessarily means taking the whole entire series to a dark place. I just mean it as in not being handcuffed and being allowed to delve deeper into those particular humans' conditions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I see what you're saying, but you know, sitting here thinking about it, I'm not sure what more I needed to know about any of the characters in their given lives. You know, I mean,
I'm not saying it needs to be done. I just like imagining what we would have if literally JMS could have taken off all gloves and gone MMA, you know?
Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, I'll give you that. I think if anything, what I'd like to see is a bigger budget so we get a better sense of the scale of the interior of the station.
And that would be cool.
Yeah.
And speaking of terrestrial-based sci-fi stories, there's an ad for Cowboys and Aliens popping up on my screen right now. How cute.
There you go. All right, next one.
This is Neil from Bowie. Listen to show 239, the Carrie Devereaux interview, and it's a great interview, and it just keeps on pointing out what might have been, and it's just such a shame that we didn't get so much of a crusade. And this weekend, Big Finish, which makes Doctor Who audios, just announced that they got the license to do some Blake 7. Audios with discs, each disc with two original cast members, and so it just makes me think that, you know, the potential is out there for Babylon 5 and Crusade. They could do something similar. It'd be great to continue the story on somehow.
Well, I think it gets back to the reason why we don't have new novels and why we don't have reissues of the old novels, and it's back to Warner Brothers and licensing agreements.
I would love somebody to just find out for sure what the holdup is with licensing anything for B5, because I think DC could make some money reissuing those comics is a, you know, collected graphic novel, because some of them I haven't even seen.
Right. You know? Now, as a follow-up here, Neil did send in an email where he contacted Paul Sprague of Big Finish, and Paul responded to Neil's email with this. There's a bit of a chat about this on the Big Finish Day live podcast. We have in the past looked into getting Babylon 5, but with no success. I don't know what stopped it, be it cost of the license, JMS not wanting to hand control over to others, or something else entirely, but we tried and failed. So you're unlikely to see new Babylon 5 from us, certainly not anytime soon at least.
And the thing is, if it's merely a cost issue, I would like to know what Warner Brothers is throwing out there as a cost to license something, what that license encompasses, how long that license is good for, and why they've priced it where they've priced it, if price is what's scaring people away.
See, I just want to know that. I keep coming back to the thing that Peter David mentioned in his interview, I think it was Catherine who had mentioned it, was that there's something else that nobody can talk about.
And the fact that they can't talk about it?
Right.
Oh!
I mean, if Babylon 5 isn't such a tremendous franchise, you know, it's like by contrast, when you've got a Star Trek script, especially back when they were doing the movies with Shatner and Nimoy and everything, they put out dummy scripts to see who stole them so they could plug the leaks.
Yes.
okay? Because it was that big a deal. Well, obviously, Warner Brothers doesn't, you know, they spent maybe $1 million on Lost Tales just to see, you know, okay, well, then all the B5 fans snapped it up, but it wasn't enough for them to pony up any more money. So obviously, they don't have such consideration for it that it's a big deal for them. So why is it a big deal that we can't get the license for it? It seems to me that it is something other than money. That maybe it's come back to like what Jeffrey was talking about and others have said is and JMS, that it's about the corporate infighting as opposed to anything else. I don't know. It's frustrating.
You know what? We need a diehard B5 fan to get hired at TMZ and take this on as the ultimate mole project.
We just need to unleash some shock on the office.
No, seriously. No. So find somebody at like some low-level person at WB who's in the know, take them out for tequila shots, get them stupid drunk, and maybe they'll let something slip.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit louder into the Psycor badge, please?
There you go.
All right, next one.
Hey, Badcasters, this is Gary from Jacksonville, and I got to see the last shuttle launch this week. Unfortunately, I got to see it the way most Americans did. It was much too cloudy in Jacksonville for me to see the launch, so I watched it on TV. The week before, I decided to take my kids out to the Kennedy Space Center so they could see a shuttle on a pad one last time. And my kids really got a kick out of it. It was really nice. I want them to see things with their own eyes wherever they can. It was nice. My daughter got to see what's called the Astrovan that the astronauts ride in while we were on our little tour around Kennedy Space Center. And when we were watching it on TV, she noticed it and said, "Hey, Dad, that was the van we saw when we were traveling." It was nice for her to make that sort of, mental, physical connection to realize that, this isn't makeup, this isn't make-believe, this is, things that can be accomplished, and, I like to impress that upon my kids. Also, to flip to a different franchise for a minute, at the Kennedy Space Center, they're running one heck of a Star Trek exhibit. It's probably the best thing I've seen since they shut down Star Trek Experience in Vegas, so I definitely recommend going out and seeing it. Also, just because the shuttle's ended, that doesn't mean there's still not things to be seen in Florida, in Houston, Texas, in Alabama. There's still a lot of space information that can be imparted without actually seeing a rocket ride, and I recommend everybody, to go and take a look at these type of things. I heard you talking about where the different space shuttles will go. To my knowledge, Brett was right. The Endeavor is going to California, to Science Center out there, at least somewhere in the Los Angeles area. The Atlantis, the last shuttle to fly, will be staying at the Kennedy Space Center when everything is said and done. The Discovery will be going up to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., to the, I believe it's the Hoodsay Annex for the Air and Space Museum. The Enterprise, which is currently at the in Washington, D.C., at the Smithsonian, will be going in New York City. To my knowledge, it's going to be put on a barge next to the Intrepid Air and Space Museum in New York City. I believe I have counted for all of them. Yes, I believe I have, yes. The big surprise for the whole space shuttle thing was that that nothing went to Houston or Alabama. Many people thought that one would, but I guess other things won out. Anyway, that's it for the moment, guys. Take care. Bye.
Did they ever publish an official count of how many people went to see the final launch? Because I had heard one news report that said something they were expecting something close to like 200,000 people. And I'm like, what, huh?
Well, I mean, when you say seeing the launch, how many of that is people pulling over to the side of the road on the highway? I don't know. I haven't gone looking for that information.
Yes, and just for my peeps in the Maryland area, like Neil, and I gotta throw a shout out to NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. That was in my home stomping grounds. Went there many times. Spent a summer working on computers there. It was a lot of fun. I miss that place. They were cool there. But, yeah. And we still have stuff on NASA Channel. At least I do. Do you get NASA Channel?
I don't now, no. Although, I go online and I watch stuff. And I missed the launch because I was, shall we say, dealing with the legal system.
I was sleeping.
Oh, you have no excuse.
Exhaustion's an excuse, trust me.
Okay.
Right. Next.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie, with his show 240, and with the mention of other voices on too. Just wanted to mention at the end of that volume, I was glancing at that. There is the lengthy discussion on the ordering of the Crusade episode, and Jason presents his best order that he can come up with, where including unproduced scripts and scripts that weren't that were planned but not written, and so forth. And anyway, it's a fascinating discussion, and quite recommended take a look at. And
and that's the end.
We are still planning to talk a little bit about the unproduced scripts, right?
Yes, I think there's value in that. I think if nothing else, we get a sense of what could have been. Reading Peter Woodward's script yeah. for Little Bugs Have Lesser Bugs, one of the things that struck me on that was how well he had captured the voices for all the characters. I mean, while there were rough patches in it, it didn't feel like it was, you know, an actor's, hey, I want to write a script kind of thing. It was like, it was a very well considered story.
Right. It did not feel like half-assed work. It was really, right, really, right. really polished.
And I could really hear and see in my mind's eye the various characters going about their things from what we'd seen in previous Crusades. So yes, I think we definitely need to discuss those. You know, and obviously we'll give recaps and whatever else so that people who haven't gotten the books will feel terribly left out. So, of course, we'll only be adding to the frustration of the fact that we didn't get 5 years of Crusade, but that's, you know, that's a side effect.
Okay. I'm better. Right. I'm better now.
Next one, Mike.
Hey, Fabcasters, it's Arkell. Listening to the conversation you're having in 243 about the gathering. Hey, by the way, Gary, I wonder where you got that idea to rewatch a television series from the beginning. Could it have anything to do with a certain podcast I launched back in October? Anyway, you guys are having a conversation about, you know, Kosh and the poison and everything. Boy, I really boiled it down there, didn't I? But I have a theory about this that will break your brain. Basically, Kosh passed out and let Dr. Kyle into the suit and everything because when Jeffrey Sinclair went into the past and became Valen, he told them that that was what happened. Stable time loop. I'll not comment on that further. Instead, you guys can drink however much scotch it'll take to help that make sense.
You know what it makes me think of at that point? Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure toward the end of the movie.
A trash can. Don't forget a trash can.
Right, exactly. Hey, if we were going to leave clues for ourselves, where would we put the key to the jail? Under the bush. You know, right where they're standing. Yeah. I mean. Actually, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is one of the best time travel movies ever made, I think.
It is. And I'm going to chalk it up to my standard answer. It was in the script. We know that a lot of things changed between The Gathering and Midnight on the Firing Line. Certain aspects of certain characters changed. There was a whole year in between. And yes. Some of those things had to change. And I'm good with that. I really am.
I, You know, again, this is one of those instances, I think, where you have to consider the fact that it's I hate to say it this way. You have to remember that it's a television show and not an actual real world. You know, so the reason it doesn't make sense, like you said, is it's in the script. It's because JMS had a year to between the pilot and the first episode of the first season to reconsider some things and work some stuff over and make it stronger. I mean, you remember the magic rings of the Dark Lord, the elves that Delenn had?
Oh, yeah.
Thank God we never saw those again.
The gravity rings? No, those could have been fun.
No, that was stupid.
Oh, come on.
That was stupid. It was stupid.
Nope, they could have been fun.
No, it was stupid. JMS had just put down his box set of Lord of the Rings books and wrote that scene in.
Dude, think about what Delenn could have done with Sheridan in bed with us.
Oh, well, woohoo, yeah, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah, I know. Yes, you get the whole gravity thing pulsing and whatnot. Okay, never mind.
Next one.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie. Listening to Show 240, the interview with Pat Salmon, the great interview. And just thinking, she said that what she wants in her book is to answer all the things that that fans want to know. So I know that in the interview, she didn't get all that much chance to answer all the questions that we all had for her. So is Pat going to come back to another interview soon, or are you just going to send all those questions to Pat and she can answer those in her book? That's all.
Yes.
What he said. I think, I don't know. I think it's probably at this point too late to give her questions for the book.
Yes.
Because
it's published.
Not yet. Not quite yet. I mean, she'll have copies of it at San Diego Comic-Con, which from the date of this recording is 2 weeks from now. And the book officially comes out in August. So,
but would we love to have Pat back on so that she can talk about the book and talk about what went in it and talk about what didn't get in it? Of course. Mm-hmm.
Yes. She has already offered that she's more than welcome to come back on after the book is out. So probably sometime later in towards the end of August, maybe.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah, so you get more dose of Pat Tallman goodness.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie, listening to Show 240 with Pat Tallman. She said that she stunts on some 50 Star Trek episodes, so I have to wonder if there are any of those episodes that if we freeze the frame on some of those stunts, whether we can actually tell whether it's Pat in that shot or not. So anyway, that's a question for her in some future time.
I have to admit that I haven't gone back looking for Pat Tallman stunt woman at all. And frankly, I prefer Pat Tallman, the actress, because mm-hmm. I'd like to see and hear her speak rather than watch her plummet 10 stories to her doom.
So there are actually episodes of Next Generation where you could pick her out doing whatever, falls, dives.
Well, I guess. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I didn't know that she was a stunt woman for the show until we interviewed her, you know, when she first came on.
Well, I knew she did stunts. I didn't realize that she had extensive stunt work on Next Gen.
I don't know about extensive. In fact, there's really only one episode I can think of, and I know Gary will probably be able to corroborate or disprove, but she, as I recall, really the one episode she was in was Starship Mine, where the Enterprise is emptied of everybody as they're basically irradiating it to clean it up or whatever, and the group of terrorists comes on board to scrape out the dilithium crystal chamber or something to get some very valuable thing. And the only person left on board is Picard, and he's basically running around with a bow and arrow taking him out.
Yeah, he's playing the barber, and for some reason I just got this impression while watching that. I'm like, there's one scene where he's going to break out either playing a lute or playing a fiddle, skipping down the hallway like one of Robin Hood's merry men, because this is crap. I remember that episode being completely, I was waiting for someone to wake up and go, wow, that was a crazy LSD dream I had.
Yeah, it's one of those where, you know, well, I mean, it stretches credibility. You know, you've got a massive starship. You really think they're going to pull everybody off of it? You know, why don't they, like, clean?
I don't know. Here's the problem I had with that. They are, in effect, sheep dipping a freaking starship.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sheep dipping a starship. Really? Really? Is that the best idea you could come up with?
Is the USS Enterprise.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. The crew of the Enterprise are just the fleas. Here's the sheep dip.
Yeah, right.
People wonder why I got sick of that show. Next.
Hey, Babcast, this is Gary, and I wanted to bring you up a little bit today with some of the Facebook Babylon 5 news. Just in the past day or so, as I'm calling in, JMS put out a call to try and find out the whereabouts of Michael O'Hare. Much like our beloved Summer, he had been stifled and really could not track her down through fan submissions. He was able to, I believe, get in touch with someone who knew Michael O'Hare. I'm told he is alive, and that's pretty much where it ended. I was personally hoping for a bit more of a happy sort of, oh, everything's, you know, fine and rosy, and I didn't quite get that from JMS's post, but he was in touch with him. He says it has nothing to do with anything Babylon 5 related, so you can just quell the rumor mill right here and now. He was just curious how Michael was, and so I didn't get a good sense of how Michael was so much as he is still with us. So I will talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Yeah, that is one place where I ran into dead ends I could not overcome.
Yeah. And God, I'd love to talk to Michael O'Hare, because there's the story there. And even if he doesn't, you know, if he says, I can't say anything about that, I think it would put a lot of fans' minds at ease to know that he's doing well. Because there's so many rumors that get floated around. Just start Googling some of that. And I think very little of it has any grain of truth, but it's just a lot of, you know, it's a lot of ugly innuendo and things like that. It's like, you know, the guy deserves at least to have a voice, say, look, it wasn't like that. I can't tell you all the ins and outs, but everything's fine. Relax. I don't know.
Oh, it would be fun. You know, even if you could say, you know, hey, it's in the past. You know, can't really talk about it.
Right.
Let's talk about Fast and Zip.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I get the sense that he's not even in acting anymore.
Not at all.
That's just the vibe I get from it, is that he just has completely left the business. I could be wrong. Don't give me, you know, please, people, don't write in and tell me that I'm an idiot. Well, you can write in and tell me I'm an idiot. That's okay, too. But I just get the sense that he's just dropped out of the whole business. So there you are.
Well, this is Neil from Bowie, listening to show 238, and I just heard the promo for the Phoenix Comic Con, which had Stan Lee saying that he's going to be there. And surprisingly, he's going to be making his way to, I think, a few conventions this year. He's going to be coming to Baltimore
in August, and so I plan to see him there. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that. Moving on.
Okay.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there might be a new season of Superhumans coming up on History Channel in the fall. I'm not sure, not 100% sure anyway. Yeah, Stan does the summer convention circuit, and his tweets are hilarious sometimes.
Yeah.
They always end with Excelsior.
Of course they do.
Uh-huh.
He has a cameo.
Yeah, I would have thought they'd have ended with Nuff Said, but Excelsior is good, too.
Yeah, Excelsior is good.
Is that our last voicemail?
That is our last voicemail.
Okay, let's take a really quick break, and I'm sure you have more emails stacked up, don't you?
Yeah, I've got a few more emails.
Okay.
I'm Michael R. Menengay.
I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Michael Stackpole.
And I'm Brian Brown.
Join us for an exciting romp through literature and books.
Romp? We're not romping.
We're supposed to be cool.
That's smooth. Right. Okay. It's the cool.
It's the smoothing sounds.
The smoothing sounds.
I don't know, but romp just brings forth images of Michael in tights, and I'm so not going there.
Well, which Michael?
It doesn't matter. Neither one would be very good.
If you would like to join this thing that we do every week, it's called Dragon Page, cover to cover.
Take two. Welcome to Dragon Page, cover to cover, where the elite meet to discuss literature.
Okay, let's go back to the tights images.
Yeah.
Dragon Page, cover to cover, where you'll never know what you're going to get next. Email time?
Yeah, we've got a couple here. This one comes to us from Ben. Ben writes, "Hey folks, the influence that B5 has had on other shows has been a regular topic of conversation over the years. But I think it would be really interesting to have a few shows at least on the stories and shows that have influenced B5. JMS clearly had numerous influences in creating and writing Babylon 5. And as such, this could be a fertile ground for discussion, not only of other SF and fantasy, but other genres too. You could also look into reviewing JMS's other works. Obviously, on a selective basis, the world doesn't need the B5 podcast review of Murder, She Wrote. Keep up the great podcasting." Well, I don't know. Don't you think Jessica Fletcher could be seen as a predecessor of Garibaldi?
I'm thinking a predecessor to Teamoff.
Yeah, there you go. I think, I don't know that we dedicate whole shows to the discussion of influences. JMS himself has gone on record that, you know, Lord of the Rings is a prime influence. Obviously, the Lensman series is an influence. Hard to say, you know. From what I read, Straczynski is such a wide ranging reader that I think you're going to find influences from places that we wouldn't even think to look if you really started digging into it. What say you?
I think that JMS himself might not know all of the stories that influenced him.
Yeah, I think it's more a sense of, you know, writers. Rod Serling has been noted as an influence. Harlan Ellison, obviously, is an influence. Yeah, I don't know.
It'd be fun to make a list, though. You know how we geeks get about lists.
Yeah, right? The top 10 worst things to happen to comics in 2010. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, I've got one other item here. This was sent to our attention by Neil and Bowie. and he ended up linking to a post on the JMS News site. And this is actually posted by Jan Schroeder. And this comes through all the blah, 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 all the links and everything. It's actually originally posted on JMS's Facebook page. Here's some important breaking news regarding a new book by Harlan Ellison, which involves Babylon 5, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, and how to write science fiction if you really want to be a professional. And this is more in-depth from what I guess JMS writes. It says, I don't have to tell you who Harlan Ellison is or that he wrote some of the most seminal episodes of science fiction television in history of the form. His scripts for The Outer Limits, Star Trek, Twilight Zone, and others have won countless awards and are considered landmarks of the genre. A while back, I got wind of a top-secret project being developed by Publishing 180, the company that publishes the Babylon 5 script books involving Harlan's scripts for these series. Important note, I do not own any part of P180, nor do I receive any financial remuneration of any kind from this project. My involvement here is strictly as a fan and admirer. I now hold in my hand a preliminary copy of that book, and I wanted to give everyone a heads up because, folks, this is a doozy. The book, entitled Brain Movies, contains Harlan's scripts for Soldier and Demon with a Glass Hand from The Outer Limits, Paladin of the Lost Hour, and Crazy as a Soup Sandwich from The Twilight Zone, Memo from Purgatory from Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Face of Helen Bornau, and Harlan's near-legendary manifesto on how to write good science fiction written exclusively for incoming writers on Babylon 5. In many cases, the book contains both the script and the treatment for the script, something almost never seen outside the studio. Most amazing of all, the book contains not just the shooting script for Harlan's Hitchcock episode, it contains an earlier draft filled with his handwritten annotations and changes. When an episode is broadcast, you don't get to see the writer's mind at work, don't have the opportunity to experience the moment he decided to make a line of dialogue or a scene go this way instead of that way, how a turn of phrase was altered in just the right way at the right last moment. You see only the end product. By including the draft with the handwritten annotations, you can see the creative process being enacted right before your eyes. The opportunity to see inside the writer's mind is unspeakably rare. Best of all, these are not re-typeset versions of the script. They are painstakingly scanned reproductions of the original scripts exactly as they were written. And for budding science fiction writers out there, what better than having Harlan Ellison break down in his manifesto how to write effectively in the genre, how to avoid various kinds of traps and make your writings better. When I heard that Harlan was going to include the B5 manifesto, entitled A Terrifying List of Things Not to Do When Writing for Babylon 5, I offered to write an introduction to the volume entitled Touching Magic. That introduction is now also in the book. Last and maybe coolest of all, because of the presence of B5 material, they are doing a limited number of books that are dual autographed by both myself and Harlan. With only one prior exception, this is the only time that Harlan and I have autographed something together and never before for a published book. So.
And when can I get that?
This book will go on sale in a couple of weeks. I think it's somewhere around the 20th, and those already on the B5 mailing list will get the announcement automatically. But I'll be sure to post the info here the second goes online.
Damn it. I'm going to have to sell something in order to buy that book, aren't I?
I'm guessing so, yeah. And kind of looking through some of the later posts in the JMS News forum by Jan and Jason Davis, they haven't yet given pricing nor announced the release date, so... So there you go, guys.
I'm sitting here looking amongst my collectibles, seeing what I can sell. I have a first edition signed copy of Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman. I can't sell that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you might have to sell a kidney.
No, I can't sell a kidney. I need those.
Yeah, well, you know. There's that. So there you go, guys. It's not only fans of JMS, but fans of Harlan Ellison. You'll get a double dose there by picking up that book.
I imagine.
Now, here's the other thing that I thought was curious. They mentioned that the publisher is actually named Publishing 180.
Yeah, if you look inside the script books, you'll see that.
Okay. I didn't look that closely, so consider me educated now.
Edumacated?
Yeah. I'm a little bit smarter now, folks.
Just a little bit?
Just a little bit.
Yeah. Well, darn it. The movie comes out this Friday, so I don't think they're worth anything yet. Maybe not.
Now we
I saw the Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 a couple days ago, and I didn't know the movie was in 3D until I got there. I had no clue. No clue the movie was in 3D till I got there, and they handed me this pair of... I have a really cool pair of polarized Harry Potter glasses right now, and they're very, very nice lenses.
Do they have the little tape on the...
No, they don't have the little tape on the bridge, but the 3D in that movie was really cool.
Really?
I was not expecting it. If I had gone in knowing that it was 3D, I would have been grumpy. But because they sprung it on me, and because it was done differently than I expected, I might have to reevaluate my disdain towards everybody doing 3D.
Huh.
I know they're not all going to be done as well as this Harry Potter movie.
Right.
And I hope they have a 2D version of it for, you know, people with vision problems who can't process the 3D-ness of it. But you honestly cannot watch the movie without the glasses at all. It's unwatchable without the glasses.
Sure.
But they did some really interesting thing with just... in regular shots that didn't have 3D effects flying out at you, that the there was a subtlety of the 3D-ness in the character positions where it helped emphasize an emotional scene or an emotional impact on some one character that I thought was really well done.
Wow.
I just don't know that my glasses will be worth anything.
Yeah, right. Well,
I can't sell them for enough to get this book, so.
Right, right. Exactly. That's exactly right. Futurama, in a recent episode, did a very good take on the 3D thing.
Really?
Yeah, Leela and Bender are sent on to take a shipment to the planet Pandora. And Leela says, can't we just send our avatars? And the professor replies that it would be, you know, it's cheaper to send them in case they die. And of course, when they get to the planet, it's all in the blue and red, you know, overlays. And at one point in time, Leela demands Bender make her dinner, and he comes back with a peanut butter sandwich and throws it at the screen. So that was your, yeah. Right. Nice. So that's your obligatory 3D effect thing there.
Okay, then.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. It's a pretty good take on it. So anyways, but that doesn't help you sell anything to get that book either. And I'm going to wager that given what the price point has been on most of the other B5 books, that it's probably going to be in a similar price range.
I wonder if they're going to have like the limited edition signed by both JMS and Uncle Harlan.
Oh, that's a kidney and another organ. Absolutely. Oh,
man. See, that's what I was worried about.
Yeah. Yeah. No, if you want that one, huh? Yeah. Have you thought about becoming a hitman?
I have.
And?
Believe it or not, it's not a growth industry anymore. I missed my window of opportunity after Gross Point Blank came out. You know?
Yes, I wonder how you apply for unemployment. Former hitman, unemployed hitman. Why don't you go on monster.com and look for jobs for hitman?
He made his stunning debut with the bombing on the...
Yeah.
Never mind. Next email.
That's it. That's all I got that's for it. Now. Yeah.
That's a, that, no, don't get me started on Gross Point Blank quotes, because that just goes into dangerous, dangerous place.
All right.
That's
it for all I got. You got anything else?
I... Eeny, meeny, my... No, I do not. Other than... Still have an open invite to JMS to come back on the show to talk about
the movement in the tall grass. Whatever.
just saying, when he's allowed to say something, we would like the opportunity to interrogate. I mean, ask him about it first.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not. I'm now. He's pulling a Warner Brothers.
Given the Warner Brothers history, I'm totally cool with not wanting to jinx the cat, you know.
Well, I just don't think there's a cat. I think if you open that box, there'll be illegal drugs in it, and that's about it.
So you don't think there's a cat in the box at all? Interesting.
I don't think there's a cat in a box at all. I don't think it's a dead cat or a live cat. I think it's a no cat.
Okay. I don't know what that does to quantum theory, but that's a very interesting perspective on it. Anyway, no, I do not have any more.
Okay.
Other than having people add to our, we have a short list of B5 guest stars who I'm trying to get on the show to talk about, you know, their moments on B5 and anything else they've been working on. And like I said, Tucker's the first of many. I'm working on John Vickery and Marshall Teague and
Michael York.
I think he would be kind of a hard get. But if you really want to, I'll investigate.
Yeah, just see.
The other person who I couldn't find, believe it or not, was Marjorie Monaghan. Like, what the hell happened there?
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
There's no contact information in the usual places. So I'm going to have to do some alternative digging there.
There you go.
Happened. And there are a few other people on the list that you and Brett sent in, and I'm going to save those as surprises for people. But other listeners out there might have suggestions that we might have overlooked. You know, people to chat with. Non-regulars, you know, those special guest stars. And, of course, we could always invite Jason back on to talk for another 3.5 hours, right?
Yes, absolutely.
We should probably try to find Robin Akin Downs again.
Yes, that would be another good one to find, because his interview, if you want to call it that, was
That was a stream of consciousness rant, anger at the freeway, I believe.
Yes.
but we can work on those. So send in your questions to us, people. As always, the website is babylonpodcast.com. Come on by, visit, leave your comments. Click the donate button because, you know, those dust storms do kick up, you know, tend to increase the heat, and we need to keep the studio cool. So go ahead and click that donate button. Again, the email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. You can send in your own emails, or if the voicemail line is busy, you can record your own messages and email those in there. And, of course, that voicemail line is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here the great war came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.